Good afternoon. Today's Thursday, August 14th, and you're listening to the Arizona Republic Hour 1. My name is Karen Kelly, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll be reading news from Valley and State, followed by news from USA Today. Some of the top stories we'll be starting with would be Mays pushes back on tariffs, as well as 200 lose jobs after Fed raid of Colt Grill. So let's start off. Mays pushes back on tariffs by Stacey Barchinger. Attorney General Chris Mays walked into Nogales City Hall seeking to gather information that could aid her office's case challenging Trump administration tariffs, and left roughly 2 hours later with ideas in mind for a new case, or maybe two new cases. And there was an affirmation. I came away from this even more determined to win this lawsuit and concerned if we don't, Mays said. I really am worried about pretty much every border community in Arizona if we don't win this lawsuit. Both sides of the border have a stake in everything not falling apart. Mays, a Democrat elected in 2022, who has filed 25 cases against President Donald Trump and his administration, visited Nogales on August 12th as part of her ongoing town hall tour of the state. Don't you dare back down. She has led 30-something town halls in her first 2.5 years in office. They have covered topics as vast as the Grand Canyon state itself, a proposed mining project in Chino Valley, education funding, and broadband in St. John's, federal funding, and staff cuts in Yuma. She's already planning the next one, or two, or three events, ideas that she throws out to staff throughout the day in Nogales. We should do a town hall, she often begins. Coming up on her calendar is a September town hall in Gilbert to gather information about when health insurance companies deny claims. Her office is looking into the issue, she said. The day in Nogales began with a stop at the Santa Cruz Council on Aging's Senior Center, where she shared tips for preventing scams with about 90 residents. Mays warned them never to give personal information, such as their bank account number, address, and social security number over the phone. She told them to monitor bank accounts and talk about suspicious activity with family members or loved ones. Giggles rippled through the room when she began discussing romance scams. But the loudest applause came when the topic turned to Trump. Marcelino Verona, president of the Santa Cruz Council, praised Mays' lawsuits against the Trump administration so far. Verona said he has been a Republican since the 1970s, and he voted for Mays in 2022. I'm glad that you are partnering with other attorneys generals to go against the convicted felon in Washington, D.C., and I hope you keep up the good fight, he told Mays, and don't you dare back down. Facing Trump's tariffs, Nogales mayor asks, how do we survive? The attorney general's lawsuit against Trump's tariffs, including those on Mexican imports, was filed in April. It was her 13th case. Arizona and other states challenged Trump's stance that a 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act gave him the authority to impose tariffs. Led by Oregon and Arizona, the states won an injunction at the International Court of Trade. That was stayed by an appeals court, which has not yet ruled on whether the tariffs can stand. Trump has delayed a higher 30% tariff on Mexican imports until November 1st, as he negotiates with Mexico on a trade deal. Tariffs are a signature element of the president's foreign and economic policy. Later on August 12th at Nogales City Hall, Mays met with cattle importers, manufacturers, produce importers, and local officials who warned that higher tariffs on Mexican goods could rupture not just the border town's economy, but also have a broader impact on Arizona and Sonora. They warned that jobs would be lost and prices for consumers who have come to rely on produce grown in Mexico could go up. The question, as Nogales Mayor Jorge Maldonado put it, how do we survive? Maldonado gave Mays a bag filled with tomatoes, bell peppers, and cucumbers, representing the food that comes in daily through the Nogales port. Nogales Feeds America was printed on the bag. If there was a through line of the participants' frustration, it was the lack of stability in an industry where planning and timing matter, for example, to put pepper seeds in the ground months before a harvest. Tariffs have been put in place and then delayed, with others threatened. Cattle imports were halted because of concern about parasites, and that closure extended. Two cattle importers told Mays they fear cattle will only be allowed to come through certain ports that, to the people herding them, don't make geographic sense. All of our products end up on Americans' plates, said Jordan Bell, whose family runs CattleMex, an importer. She said tariffs, as well as U.S. Department of Agriculture orders, threaten her business. Reducing the number of ports available for cattle imports to just one could have consequences, she said. It's like a state with one hospital. When an emergency happens, you need two, she said. The issue stuck with Mays as she left the event, turning to a staffer to brainstorm. How would Arizona have standing, that is, the ability to show it is being harmed and thus a reason to sue? Maybe the beef is sold in Arizona schools, she wondered. Or the state could pursue another angle raised by Santa Cruz County leaders, who noted the Nogales port charges an additional $75 fee on overweight trucks carrying produce. The money funds city, county, and state road projects and could be threatened if fewer trucks hauling produce cross because of Trump's tariffs, meaning a tangible impact on government bank accounts, Mays says. Jamie Chamberlain, whose family has been importing Mexican produce for decades through Chamberlain Distributing, urged Mays to help Washington, D.C. understand the potential impact on Nogales' economy. Chamberlain holds several leadership positions in southern Arizona, including as a member of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. The business is competitive and comes with many challenges, he said, but it is resilient. We can handle those challenges, he said. We have challenges, whether it's climate, whether it's labor, whether it's water. We're always going through droughts. Those are typical challenges that we have. This is atypical. The amount of the tariffs that are proposed are out of the ranges in which we can absorb. Chamberlain said he has paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in tariffs. Still, he expressed some trepidation about Mays' take-them-to-court approach and its potential for unintended effects. I don't want the federal government to believe that we are being antagonistic, he said. I don't want them to think that we're poking the bear. Almost everything we do with our ports of entry is a federal issue. We have a great reputation in the way we work with our federal partners. The Attorney General is going to do what the Attorney General is going to do. It's up to her, he said. But as a community, I wouldn't want to see any negative repercussions, Chamberlain said, adding that he had not yet seen that in Arizona. Mays acknowledged the concern after lunch with Chamberlain, Maldonado, and others at Nogales restaurant staple Zula's. She kept the focus on the November 1st date that tariffs could go into effect. The way of the border is cooperation, and there's this centuries-long history of working together, she said. And so I think the idea of having to resolve something through a lawsuit is a little bit foreign. But also, I think they want the tariffs stopped. On November 1st, they're staring down catastrophe. I'm more than happy to be the bad guy on this, on their behalf. And that concludes the article entitled, Mays Pushes Back on Tariffs. Our next story is 200 Lose Jobs After Federal Raid of Colt Grill, written by Daniel Gonzalez. Nikki Check figured it was just a matter of time before immigration raids reached rural northern Arizona after watching ICE ramp up arrests in Phoenix, Los Angeles, and other large cities around the country. On July 15th, dozens of heavily armed federal ICE agents carried out a raid at several Colt Grill, barbecue, and spirits locations in Yavapai County. When a friend told Check, a Yavapai County supervisor, about the raid that morning via text, Check thought, oh, it's finally here. It's finally in our community. Agents arrested four people, including the husband and wife owners of the popular Northern Arizona restaurants, on felony charges of hiring and harboring undocumented workers. ICE agents also took into custody nearly two dozen workers on immigration charges. The raid came as the Trump administration escalated its immigration crackdown, which has resulted in more than 167,000 ICE arrests nationwide since January, according to ICE data. A month after the raid, the rural northern Arizona communities are still reeling from the raid's economic and emotional repercussions, Check said. The raid resulted in the closing of all four Arizona Colt Grill barbecue and spirits restaurants in the village of Oak Creek in Sedona, Prescott Valley, and Cottonwood, Check said. A fifth Colt Grill location is in Foley, Alabama. The popular restaurants, known for their cowhide seating and in-house smoked meats, were always busy, Check said. The closing of the restaurants resulted in about 200 Colt Grill employees losing their jobs, Check said. Finding new jobs could be difficult because July and August are the slow season in Yavapai County, Check said. It's significant for our small economy, for sure, she said. Some of the displaced Colt Grill workers have been assisted by the county's one-stop employment centers, which help workers find new jobs, said Craig Lefevre, the Yavapai County Workforce Development Director. Lefevre said he estimated about 200 Colt Grill were displaced by the ICE raid based on a 2022 article in the Flagstaff Business Journal. In the article, owner Brenda Clouston said the restaurants employed a staff of 200. Some local restaurants have hired some of the displaced Colt Grill employees, Lefevre said. Because of the slow season, most restaurants already have a full complement of employees. But I have heard several Prescott restaurants have gone out of their way to find positions for the displaced Colt Grill employees, Lefevre said. On July 15th, federal agents with Homeland Security Investigations, which is part of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, raided four Colt Grill barbecue and spirits locations in Prescott, Prescott Valley, the village of Oak Creek, Sedona, and Cottonwood in northern Arizona, and one Colt Grill location in Foley, Alabama. Federal agents arrested the owners of the restaurants, Robert and Brenda Clouston, both 61, and two others, Luis Pedro Rogel-Jaimes, 33, and Iris Romero-Molina, 29, on charges of conspiracy to transport illegal aliens, conspiracy to harbor illegal aliens, conspiracy to encourage and induce an alien to unlawfully enter the U.S., and a pattern of practice of knowingly employing unauthorized aliens. A federal grand jury indictment accuses the Claustons, along with Rogel, Jaimes, and Romero Molina, of taking part in a scheme to pay to have undocumented immigrants brought to the United States to work in the restaurants, creating a cleaning company to pay the unauthorized workers with funds from the restaurants, and leasing houses for some of the unauthorized workers to live in. All four have pleaded not guilty to the charges, according to court records. Rogel, Jaimes, and Romero Molina are Mexican nationals who were living in the United States without authorization, federal prosecutors said. The undocumented workers were paid below minimum wage and were not compensated for overtime, federal prosecutors said. The Claustons and Rogel, Jaimes, and Romero Molina benefited financially from the scheme and did not pay proper employment taxes for the workers, federal prosecutors said. The raid was the culmination of a three-year investigation, the prosecutor said. The Yavapai County's Sheriff's Office assisted with the investigation. Check, the Yavapai County Supervisor, noted that in April 2024, the Yavapai County Board of Supervisors signed a proclamation declaring the Republican stronghold a non-sanctuary county. The symbolic declaration was intended to encourage a local cooperation with federal authorities to carry out immigration enforcement in the rural northern Arizona county, which includes communities of Sedona, Prescott, and Cottonwood. Check, the five-member board's lone Democrat, was not on the board at the time. Many residents have mixed feelings about the ICE raid at the Colt Grill restaurants, Check said. On one hand, residents are generally happy that ICE is targeting people who federal prosecutors allege were involved with serious immigration and smuggling-related crimes, Check said. But some residents have expressed concern about the nearly two dozen undocumented workers who were also swept up in the raid and the families they left behind, Check said. These people have family members that are now separated from them, Check said. Check said she has heard concerns over how immigration arrests could disrupt life in the small, close-knit communities in Yavapai County, such as children losing friends to deportations. I would say it's added a tension in our community of uncertainty and not knowing who might be impacted by future presence of ICE, Check said. It's unclear what has happened to the undocumented workers who were arrested. Federal and state law enforcement personnel executed 26 criminal search warrants, 4 administrative warrants, and 4 arrest warrants simultaneously at 5 Colt Grill restaurant locations and 15 residential locations within Yavapai County, Arizona, and Foley, Alabama during the July 15th raid. Fernando X. Burgos Ortiz, an ICE enforcement and removal operations spokesman, said in a written statement, a total of 22 undocumented immigrants were arrested on administrative immigration violations, Burgos said. The undocumented immigrants were processed by ICE in Phoenix, and they were then transported to either the Eloy Detention Center or Florence Detention Center, Burgos said. Yavapai County Supervisor Nikki Check said about nearly two dozen undocumented workers were arrested. And that concludes the article, 200 Lose Jobs After Federal Raid of Colt Grill. Our next article is entitled, Senate President Wants FCC to Investigate Arizona PBS, written by Stacey Barchinger. The top Republican in the Arizona Senate wants federal regulators to investigate Arizona PBS following reporting that detailed how Arizona State University leaders influenced the station's coverage of candidates for governor in 2022. Senate President Warren Peterson, a Gilbert Republican, sent a letter to Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brenda Carr on August 12th requesting the investigation and citing the earlier reporting by the Arizona Republic. The Republic, relying on messages obtained through a public records request, showed ASU President Michael Crow and other leaders considered GOP gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake's false view that the 2020 presidential election was stolen before they broke from precedent and offered Katie Hobbs, then the Democratic nominee for governor, airtime. The FCC should investigate Arizona PBS's blatant viewpoint discrimination against Carrie Lake and partisan calculations designed to benefit Katie Hobbs, Peterson wrote in the August 12th letter to the FCC. I respectfully request that the FCC take appropriate enforcement action, including license revocation, to protect the public interest and ensure that Arizonans will not be subjected to biased media manipulation in future elections. Peterson, who is running for the Republican nomination for Arizona Attorney General next year, did not immediately respond to text messages or a call seeking comment. Fox News' digital operation first reported on Peterson's letter. Asked for comment, ASU spokesman Jay Thorne emailed a link to an ASU website that largely reiterates that the decision to offer interviews nearly 3 years ago was made out of concern that giving only Lake an interview would violate equal time rules that apply to broadcasters. The page reaffirmed that Lake declined that interview while Hobbs accepted it. When Hobbs decided not to debate Lake, the Clean Election Commission's plan to proceed with a one-party debate conflicted with Arizona PBS's licensing requirements, the website reads. That is, despite experts previously telling the Republic that debates are exempt from equal time rules. Peterson's request comes amid GOP dominance in Washington, D.C., which has brought elevated attacks on broadcasters and other journalists that President Donald Trump and other Republicans accused of being biased. Congress last month pulled back over $1 billion in funding for public broadcasters, which put some stations in rural areas at risk of closure. The FCC reinstated complaints against television networks, and Trump has sued prominent organizations, including The Wall Street Journal, over coverage of his ties to the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. The Republic reporting revealed private discussion between Crow and his aides that led to the university offering then-candidate Hobbs an interview on Arizona PBS, though she had declined to debate Lake. The university's public broadcasting station, Arizona PBS, had a decades-old contract with the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission to air political debates and terms and rules said if only one candidate agreed to a debate, they would get a one-on-one interview. The voter-approved commission provides public funding to some candidates and does voter education. In 2022, Hobbs skipped two debates. Her campaign said she would not debate Lake, whose campaign focused on the claims that Trump won the 2020 presidential race. Instead of following agreed-upon terms and past practice, ASU and Arizona PBS offered both Lake and Hobbs interviews on its public affairs show. The timing led to frantic fallout. Hobbs revealed on national television she was offered the airtime. Clean Elections pulled out of Lake's interview that had been scheduled to record later that afternoon, and Lake called a press conference pledging not to appear on Arizona PBS and accused Crow of putting his thumb on the scale. The Republic requested communications from university leaders the following day under Arizona public records law, and ASU provided those records 743 days later in 2024. The emails showed Crow was concerned about Lake's election views and the university's brand. Whatever the format there remains, the fact that it is our venue and brand, Crow wrote in a message to me, A. Parrish, a former Republic publisher who was at the time the head of ASU's media ventures. We need structure and format and people who believe in elections as participants. Parrish had also expressed in a meeting with Clean Elections staff that putting a person on television with those views was wrong, a reference to Lake. Commission Executive Director Tom Collins previously told the Republic. ASU has said it offered both Lake and Hobbs interviews in order to comply with FCC regulations or broadcasters and equal time rules. It said in a previous statement the university's goal in 2022 was providing voters with an opportunity to have information from which they could make an informed decision. Hobbs went on to win the Arizona governor's office by less than 1 percentage point. She has not taken a firm stance on whether she would debate next year when she is seeking another 4 years in office. And that concludes the article entitled, Senate President Wants FCC to Investigate Arizona PBS. Our next article is Old Town Looking to Grow Up a Little, written by Corina Vanek and Sean Raimundo. Long known as a destination for college students and those wishing they were still college students, a handful of new restaurant and hospitality developments aim to pivot Old Town Scottsdale away from a nightclub culture to appeal to a broader range of demographics. This has been a calculated shift by our company to elevate the offerings in the hospitality district, said Lisa Druce, a spokesperson for Riot Hospitality, which owns and operates several restaurants and clubs in Old Town. A lot of this has been in the works for years. Riot Hospitality recently opened Shiv Supper Club, located at the site of a former nightclub. We saw a need to bring back the iconic supper club, Drew said. The restaurant also has a separate dessert room where patrons can come just to get a dessert or cocktail. Along with Shiv's Supper Club, other businesses that have leaned into embracing a more mature audience include the new Sexy Roman restaurant at the W Scottsdale Hotel, Mother Tucker's Tavern, which also replaced a nightclub, and the Remy Scottsdale Hotel, which offers 4 dining and drink venues inside. Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski applauded the businesses and developers' concerted effort to elevate Old Town's image. I think it's really already showing itself to have great results, she said, pointing to the recent opening of the Remy. While she and other city officials are enthusiastic about the shift to a more mature downtown district, Borowski stressed the area still will be welcoming to the younger college crowd. I think there's always going to be that place for Old Town to have a younger, more entertainment-centric vibe, she said. But I love that upscale luxury is really being intentionally planned and developed. Sexy Roman replaces Sushi Roku at the W Scottsdale. The space underwent a massive renovation to create the new restaurant, which added olive wood booths with integrated ice buckets, hand-troweled plaster walls, and custom artwork. The kitchen is led by James Beard-nominated chef Jason Franey. The restaurant offers high-end Italian dishes centered on fresh pasta made in-house. Travis Strickland, chief operating officer of Alliance Hospitality, worked on both Sexy Roman and the Remy Hotel. Creating destination restaurants inside hotels makes an amenity for both the community and hotel guests, he said. I see this becoming a destination place for the community, Strickland said, of the Remy and its extensive focus on food. When I moved from the Midwest to California, I saw that people came and hung out at the hotels, especially high-end hotels with a beautiful lobby. And there aren't a lot of places like that. Rachel Smetana, Scottsdale's tourism and events director, said that while the city isn't actively driving the effort to steer Old Town toward a more mature audience and away from the clubbing and nightlife scene, it is conceptually where we want to go. The attractions of college students to our Old Town didn't really support all that we've got going on here, she said. Scottsdale wants to be seen as an arts and culture hub with museums, fine dining, and events, Smetana said. We want to have national and international significance, she said. In other words, Scottsdale wants Old Town to grow up. We're looking forward to seeing some more tasteful redevelopment, Smetana said, adding, a lot of investment is happening in Old Town, and we look forward to this next mature chapter. According to tourism data that the firm Longwoods International collected for the city, nearly one-third of Scottsdale's visitors last year came to shop. Scottsdale Fashion Square near downtown is a huge draw for those visitors, Smetana said. We're so lucky that we still have a very vibrant mall that has not only stayed successful over the years, but even improved and has a luxury focus, she said. Nightlife is still alive but changing. While Old Town enters a mature stage in its life, Borowski doesn't foresee the college crowd getting pushed out or the changes affecting the restaurants and bars that cater to the nightlife scene. There's a lot of options. I don't think to the exclusion of anyone, she said, adding, people are either sticking with their business model or updating it or changing it as they see fit. Nightclub culture isn't over, but it is changing. Riot Hospitality operates several clubs in Old Town, including Maya Day Club, Cake Nightclub, and Riot House. Evening Entertainment Group, which opened Mother Tucker's Tavern, also owns Bottled Blonde, Casa Amigos, and Hi-Fi, Kitchen, and Cocktails. We have really high-quality nightlife in the hospitality district, Druss said of Riot Hospitality. We wanted to add to that with elevated experiences, literally elevating the hospitality district. Diane Corrieri, owner of Evening Entertainment Group, said dining trends after the pandemic have shifted away from high-energy nightclubs in favor of more relaxed, lounge-like venues. People should come to Old Town and take a second look at what's going on there, Corrieri said. Things have changed. We have a whole new clientele coming in. Jason Adler, Chief Development Officer for Riot Hospitality, said dining out has become a central form of entertainment, so offering restaurants that feel unique cater to patrons' desires. They want a full experience in every single place they go, he said. Re-envisioning Old Town, perhaps with more parking. Scottsdale's general and strategic plans highlight the city's goals of creating interesting streetscapes and a walkable live-work environment downtown. It's there that the city wants to also actively promote arts and culture. Smetana stressed, though, that the city's leaders and its boards and committees aren't judging projects based on the type of businesses that are being proposed. They don't come at it with the thought of the actual business's use, but more how it fits into the built environment, she said, noting that Scottsdale has lofty development standards across the city and high property values. The citizens would have a lot to say about zoning requests and bad projects. Some of those don't generally come forward, she said. What we have is a very graceful investment in Old Town specifically. For the restaurateurs, the change is still a work in progress. Riot Hospitality is working on a redevelopment project at Camelback Road and Saddlebag Trail. The project included raising a vacant office building and redeveloping it as a restaurant, which will be named Calle Rosa. The group hasn't revealed the planned menu yet, but Druce said it will be a high-end, five-star restaurant. It takes away an eyesore of a building, she said. Councilmember Barry Graham, who chairs the city's Development Review Board, said the city needs to focus on creating conditions for Old Town to continue its evolution, like adding parking and marketing the area. There's a role that city government must play, he said, and so we're trying to not overplay that, trying to stay in our lane and just do things that we should do better. That concludes the article entitled Old Town Looking to Grow Up a Little. You're listening to the Arizona Republic Hour 1. My name is Karen Kelly with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, broadcast info, and audio on demand. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Let's continue with the next article, which is ex-TV anchor's husband pleads guilty in COVID-19 scheme, written by Elena Santa Cruz. The husband of a former Phoenix news anchor pleaded guilty in a Texas federal court to conspiring to defraud the government of COVID-19 relief funds. Nathan Reese and his wife Stephanie Hockridge co-founded Blue Acorn, a financial technology company that helped businesses apply for the Federal Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, which was intended to aid struggling businesses during pandemic restrictions. Hockridge worked as an anchor for ABC 15 in Phoenix for 7 years before leaving television in 2018. The couple was accused of fabricating documents to apply for hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans they weren't eligible for. They then created VIPP, a service where they coached borrowers on how to file fraudulent PPP loan applications and received kickbacks tied to the loan size, according to their indictment. Reese changed his plea in court on August 11th, days after he signed off on a plea agreement, in which he agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. He previously faced that charge and four counts of committing wire fraud. Between April 2020 and May 2021, Reese and his wife submitted fraudulent PPP loan applications that included false income and payroll information so they could receive funds that weren't eligible for, according to a factual summary filed in federal court. The couple knew the applications, including fake details, so they could make more money, the court record said, and they charged borrowers fees based on a percentage of the loan amounts that were funded. They submitted the applications through an interstate wire near Scottsdale to financial institutions in Arizona, California, and Texas, the court record said. The duo founded Blue Acorn in April 2020 and used multiple entities to do business under that name, the court record said. Reese was no longer involved in the corporate operations of the company around March 2021, but he was still part of the conspiracy until about May 2021, it said. Reese and his wife also submitted false PPP loan applications for themselves and their businesses, the court record said. They fabricated tax documents, altered bank statements, and made other misrepresentations to deceive lenders and the U.S. Small Business Administration into giving them loans they weren't eligible for, it said. Around April 2020, Reese obtained a fraudulent PPP loan of more than $69,000 for one of his companies after falsely saying in tax documents that its employees, including himself and Hockridge, were being paid, according to the court record. Reese and his wife also applied for at least 9 other loans under false pretenses, it said. Reese was scheduled to be sentenced on November 21st and faces a maximum of 20 years in prison. Hockridge found guilty in loan scheme after going to trial. A federal jury in June found the former news anchor guilty of conspiring to commit wire fraud after a week-long trial. She was found not guilty of 4 counts of wire fraud. Hockridge argued she was misled and worked to identify and stop fraud. Her lawyers described her actions as a sincere effort to support small businesses during a time of unprecedented need and claimed that she had been kept in the dark by her husband. But one text message she reportedly sent her husband showed Hockridge knew what was going on. "This is us trying to apply for free money when we don't quite qualify, LOL. A 2022 congressional report released by the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis found Hockridge was deeply involved in the day-to-day operations of Blue Acorn and how it reviewed loan applications. It also found that the company did not prioritize small businesses and instead focused on the largest applications that would earn them the most. Hockridge's sentencing was scheduled for October 10th, and she faces up to 20 years in prison. That ends the article that's entitled Ex-TV Anchor's Husband Pleads Guilty in COVID-19 Scheme. Our next article is Death Penalty Sought in Valley Cop's Killing, written by Perry Vandell. Pinal County Attorney Brad Miller announced that his office would seek the death penalty against the man accused of killing Apache Junction officer Gabriel Facio in June. Roger Nunez, 37, was booked into Pinal County Jail on multiple felony charges, including first-degree murder, after a nearly 2-week hospital stay. Facio, who also was hospitalized, succumbed to his injuries on June 8th, 6 days after he was shot in the face. Miller, flanked by several chiefs of Pinal County police departments, said he came to the decision to seek the death penalty against Nunez after consulting with members of his office and Facio's family. "It was a difficult decision," Miller said at an August 12th news conference. "But at the same time, it's the right decision. Because people who attack a single law enforcement officer attack every law enforcement officer, and that's something that we need to take seriously." Miller said Facio, being an on-duty police officer when he was killed, was one of the aggravating factors that made Nunez eligible for the death penalty. If Nunez is convicted of first-degree murder at trial, a jury ultimately would aid whether he receives the death penalty, Miller said. The county attorney added that a video a civilian recorded with a phone captured Facio's fatal injury from the side of the road and eventually would be released to the public. "And that video, once you watch it, you'll see, likely, the reason why I made the decision that I did," Miller said. "Because you can see exactly him raising a gun up, pointing that weapon at Officer Facio and firing. That was the kill shot. That was the shot that went through his face." Miller didn't give an estimated date when the video would be released. Nunez's attorneys didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. Epitome of the American dream. Miller described Facio as an epitome of the American dream for having immigrated to the United States legally and achieved his goal to become a police officer, a sentiment Facio's family and coworkers also shared at his funeral. "People wanted to work with him," Miller said. "They loved being around him, and that's why this particular case is so tragic." Apache Junction Police Chief Michael Pulley said he was in Mexico last week to attend the wedding of Facio's daughter a little over 2 months after her father's death. "It was heartbreaking," Pulley said. There were a lot of tears shed, and there were a lot of smiles made, and a lot of good memories, shared past memories and new memories that were created. But it was all done without Officer Facio. Pulley said the decision to pursue the death penalty against Nunez was a powerful statement that the decision to harm or kill members of law enforcement come with grave consequences. Both Nunez and Facio hospitalized after shootout. On the morning of June 2nd, officers responded to the area of Ironwood Drive and Ray Avenue in Apache Junction after receiving reports of a driver brandishing a gun, police said. An officer found the vehicle matching the description, a white Tesla, and stopped it, Pooley said. The driver, later identified as Nunez, was compliant and showed no signs of aggression whatsoever, the chief said at the time. When the officer asked him to step out of the vehicle, the man pulled a handgun from the glove box, got out, and began walking away, Pooley said in earlier statements. Officers followed as he walked south on Ironwood Drive while he held the gun, police said. They tried to get the man to comply with verbal orders and use less lethal means once they were near Radiance and Davis Drives, according to a department statement released that afternoon. Near Radiance Avenue, the man made a quick move and fired four rounds, hitting Facio in the face, police said. Nunez was injured when one of the officers shot back. Facio was the first Arizona police officer to die in 2025. Nunez's next scheduled hearing is on September 15th in Pinal County Superior Court. That concludes the article, Death Penalty Sought in Valley Cop's Killing. We'll continue with our next story. National Guard begins its deployment in the Capitol. Written by Trevor Hughes, Michael Luria, and Tao Nguyen. Residents and tourists in the National's capital woke up to relatively few National Guard troops patrolling the streets August 13th, amid President Donald Trump's sweeping crackdown on crime and homelessness. Trump mobilized 800 members of the Guard and ordered the city's Metropolitan Police Department to be brought under the control of the Justice Department. Trump, on August 13th, said he would ask the Republican-controlled Congress to extend federal control of Washington's police force beyond the 30-day limit. White House officials said 100 to 200 troops would provide administrative and logistical support to local law enforcement at any given time, along with a physical presence in the city. You will see them flowing into the streets of Washington in the coming weeks, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said at an August 12th news conference. They will be strong. They will be tough. Mayor Muriel Bowser's staff said on August 12th that the largest part of the surge would happen overnight, and the city planned to keep the guardsmen near tourist hotspots like the national monuments. Commanders of the Guard's 273rd Military Police Company shared images on social media of armored Humvees parked next to the Washington Monument. But National Guard troops were seldom seen along the National Mall, where tourists walked from monument to monument, and an increased police presence could be seen standing on sidewalks and in their squad cars. A roaming group of federal agents and park police patrolled the area and at one point stopped in front of a homeless man and ordered him to move, which he did peacefully. A park police helicopter flew around the mall in low circles. There were no National Guard troops to be seen. Even the area where a former Doge staffer was assaulted while intervening in an unarmed carjacking, an example of violent crime in the city highlighted by the White House, was quiet with little law enforcement presence. Mayor Fields questions. At a virtual sit-down with city residents on August 12th, Bowser said Trump called up the Guard for non-law enforcement purposes, indicating they would work in a support role to assist law enforcement officers. Bowser sought to reassure residents, saying that while violent crime remains a problem in the city, the National Guard deployment was unnecessary. Violent crime in D.C. is at its lowest level in 30 years. We had an unacceptable spike in 2023, so we changed our laws and strategies, she said at a televised community meeting on August 12th. Now, crime levels are not only down from 2023, but from before the pandemic. Our tactics are working, and we aren't taking our foot off the gas. Among comments from residents were concerns that the National Guard will do nothing to stop the influx of guns from nearby states into the city, and fears that troops roaming the streets will scare older adults and teenagers into staying inside. The three-term mayor stood by previous statements that the Metropolitan Police Department has overseen an unprecedented reduction in violent crime and hopes her administration can spin Trump's deployment of the Guardsmen into a positive for the city, considering the department is understaffed by several hundred officers. Just imagine if we had the number of MPD officers that we should have. If we were at 3,800 instead of 3,100, Bowser said. Police officials are now approaching their deployment strategy to see how the additional federal police officers can help in some ways. Kevin Donahue, Bowser's city administrator, said D.C. would aim to keep the guardsmen near national monuments, where people are accustomed to seeing armed forces, and would try to have Metro Police present wherever the troops are deployed, to give residents a more familiar face. Staff said the largest part of the surge, potentially hundreds of federal troops, would happen overnight when many residents are indoors. Mixed reactions across D.C. Earlier, on August 12th, the New York Times reported that members of the National Guard were seen in various areas across D.C., including near the Washington Monument. The troops appeared on the streets and in their military vehicles. In Anacostia, a historic and predominantly black neighborhood in southeast D.C., residents told the Times that they opposed Trump's decision to deploy the military and to place local police under federal control. "I think it's very horrible," Kevin Battle, 57, told the newspaper, "because a lot of us who are innocent are going to get caught in the middle of all this." Residents noted that the crime levels in the city did not justify the federalization of the city's police force, according to the Times and Rutgers. Rodney Miller, who has lived in the D.C. area for 50 years, told Reuters that he questioned the need for National Guard troops given lower crime levels now. Though many residents have expressed disapproval, some have shown support for the president's decision. While out on a walk with her child on August 12th, Rebecca Harkey told Reuters that crime had made her consider leaving the Capitol. "Every American should be deeply concerned." Trump's decision to deploy the military drew sharp condemnation from Democrats across the country, who said the move raises civil liberties concerns at a time when crime in D.C. is dropping. Charles Allen, a district council member overseeing the neighbors closest to the Capitol, called the deployment extreme, outrageous, and dangerous. "National Guard soldiers are trained for warfare and natural disasters, not for community policing." Policing, Allen said in a lengthy thread on social media. "Every American should be deeply concerned with what they're witnessing today." And that concludes the article, "National Guard Begins Its Deployment in the Capitol." That's all the time we have for today. Remember that you can take SunSounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Thank you for joining me for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic. My name is Karen Kelly, your SunSounds volunteer. Please stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona.